doing freelance jobs. Recently, I did a low-paid labor job. It opened my horizon. I met some interesting people, but it's still low-paid and can't compare with my previous middle management work. To me, this is a dilemma. Money is a serious matter. I worry I can't sustain myself. On the other hand, to have a new world is difficult. To have a new world is difficult. Life is so complicated. Thanks. Can Master Ajahn Brahm help? It is really difficult, but you know, you usually find that if you really, 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 really want a job, you keep on applying and applying and applying and applying and applying and applying until the management gets so fed up with you, they give you a job. That's what a friend did. He applied to this company for a job, and they said no, but he kept on applying and applying and applying and applying, you know, just every week a new application, until they realized this guy was serious and committed, so they actually hired him. So, you know, there's all sorts of different ways of finding jobs in middle management. You just got to go out there and find them. They are there. But look, how can you make yourself employable? One of the things which I learned in Buddhism, cause and effect. So if you haven't got a job, you know, don't just keep on just pushing, but find out why. Are you really employable? Are your interview skills good? You know, do you present yourself as someone who's really confident and who can do the job? You know that many people these days, when you actually can do some meditation, and you know you've done a few courses in meditation, that actually is a really positive thing for your CV. Because everybody knows these days that if you meditate, you can handle stress. And those people who can handle stress, obviously, are very, very good people to have in the workforce. Because, you know, life is very difficult these days. So, you know, increase your employability by doing some meditation, enhancing your personal skills, as well as just your academic skills. And then it's not that hard to get a job. So, keep going on. It's good to do some labor jobs as well while you're waiting for the other job. Because laboring jobs are usually, you know, casual. You can go to work for a week or 2 weeks or something. And again, that's good fun. It increases your experience of life. So that's brilliant, but never, ever give up. The people who give up are the people who fail. So keep on going, no matter what. Hi. How does one practice mindfulness in painting, in art? It's many artists have told me the same thing, is that when they really get into painting something, it is if they start the painting and then the paintbrush takes over. And they just allow the painting just to evolve. And it's just like dancers as well. You know, dancers, I remember one of my friends, he married this top Indian dancer who was on the front cover of the glossy magazines in India, throughout India. She was really quite famous. When I asked her, how do you perform to such a high level? She said, I train, 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 train. But when I perform, I forget everything I've ever learned and just let the dance take over. And I just basically disappear. And great artists, you know, even great sports people, that's usually what happens. You know, their ego, their sense of self, the sense of them doing the painting has to vanish and just let the painting just come. And you may be surprised that I've given so many talks in my life, and the very best ones is when I disappear, just let the talk come out. And sometimes I say things which surprise me. And sometimes I think, wow, where did that come from? I never planned to say that, and it's really deep and powerful. So a lot of times in life, to perform at a very high level, you know, your sense of self, your ego has to vanish. And just the camera does the shot. The brush does the painting. Now your feet do the dancing, and you're just sitting back watching in awe when these things happen. You know, in gymnastics, they say that's called getting into the zone. You get into this zone, and just things just flow perfectly. That's not just mindfulness, that's a lot of letting go. Because, you know, sometimes when you get involved, you know, you usually mess things up. When you disappear, just let things happen. It's so easy to do. Same thing in relationships as well. Don't force it, don't plan it, don't control it. Just let it happen. And then you find it's much more smooth, peaceful, and wonderful. Last time I was here, they asked me to give a talk at Hong Kong University on sex, marriage, and money, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. And there you go. What does a monk know about sex? I've been celibate for over 40 years. But, you know, this is basically what happens. You know, when the sense of self and ego, personal performance comes in, then you lose it. It doesn't become this beautiful natural flow. So all of these stuff, and when you really know how to let go of your ego, your sense of self, also the fear in the future, now when you're really in the present moment, and you basically vanish, then everything goes so beautifully, so wonderfully. And that's also in art as well. So don't try and do the painting. Get out of the way and let the painting happen. And I do that especially, not just in talking, but also in meditation. Many of you have, you know, read my books, and I talk a lot about the very deep meditations. They're called the jhanas. It's not really what I'm supposed to be talking about in this mindfulness day. These are the very powerful deep meditations that I wrote about in the Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond book. You know, sometimes people ask me, they said, Ajahn Brahm, can you really do all of those things you wrote about in the book? And to make a point, you know, I tell people, I say, no, I can't. I can't do those. I say, Ajahn Brahm has to disappear. I have to vanish, and then those things happen. And it's a very beautiful teaching about how to really meditate. If you try and do those meditations, you won't be able to. You have to vanish, disappear. Ajahn Brahm vanishes, and then all those things just happen by themselves. Just like great paintings. The artist disappears, and incredible paintings appear on the canvas. That's just how I meditate as well. Ajahn Brahm vanishes, not by me. And then meditation gets so peaceful and so incredibly deep and powerful. So that's why I say, yeah, I can't do it. No one can do it. Ajahn Chah couldn't meditate. That's my master. Ajahn Chah vanished, and then meditation happened. Do you get the idea? Good. How to practice mindfulness in a marriage where your spouse is acting superior and is never supportive and seems unwilling to be around you? Look, in a marriage, it's really difficult to actually to have this beautiful, supporting relationship. But one of the tricks which I've been teaching, you didn't hear this last year because I've only just developed this in the last few months. The secret of a happy marriage. Now, first of all, you've got to go to unhappy relationships where you're always arguing about who's right and who's wrong. And that causes so much emotional pain, distrust, and takes away the beauty of, you know, being with somebody. Fortunately, there is a very simple way of stopping all the arguments in a marriage about who's right and who's wrong. And that way is called the calendar method. And the calendar method is so simple. Whenever you have an argument with your loved one, before you try and figure out who's right and who's wrong, stop arguing, have a look at the calendar, find out what day of the month it is. Because if it's an odd day of the month, she is right. If it's an even day of the month, he is right. That way you don't have to waste all this time and this emotional hurt of arguing with someone you respect and love. The calendar decides. And of course, it is fair. Because that's the worst thing, when the other person always has to be right. They always have to be right. And this way, man's right half the time, woman's right half the time, so it's nice and easy. And for those of you who are smart, sometimes the guys figure this out first. That is unfair, because there's more odd days in the year than even ones. But give her those extra two or three. It's worth it for a happy marriage. So very easy. And sometimes people say, oh, no, that's stupid. It's not stupid. And it's actually very deep. You get some way of deciding who's right and who's wrong, which is even, without trying to find out, you know, a solution to the argument. Because arguments don't have solutions. You know, we walk away from each other thinking I'm right, and the other person thinks, no, I was right. It never ends. So use the calendar method. What day is it today? It's the 4th? 5th? 4th! So, today, he is right. So exploit it, guys, because tomorrow she's going to be right. So that's my calendar method. So simple, but actually very effective. I have suffered a huge personal tragedy and 3 years on still find it difficult to find peacefulness and happiness. Do you have any advice? Okay, my teacher Ajahn Chah, he would often just pick up a stick, and he would say, this is another stick, simile, he said, is this stick heavy? And before I could answer, he threw it away. He said, it's only heavy when you hold it. When you throw it away, it's light. It's got no weight at all. So whatever that tragedy was, the tragedy is not heavy, only that you'll keep holding it. 3 years have gone past. Isn't it time, like I threw that stick away, that you throw it away? If you want to try and do this, there's a couple of ways of doing it. The first way, you know, I taught people to do this, is write everything about the tragedy on a piece of paper and wrap it around a stick. And then take it to a forest and take that stick, you've got all the tragedy written on a piece of paper, and throw that stick as far away as you can. Do some physical act to let it go. If that doesn't work, I developed a much better strategy, which is in the new book. Because if there is any pain of the past, anything really difficult of the past, now psychologically you have to acknowledge it first of all, bring it up to the surface. So writing it down is usually the first way to actually to heal and let go of the past, acknowledging it. So whatever happened to that person who wrote that question, please write it down on paper. But my method is different than other psychologists in the type of paper you use and the color of the ink. So please write it down on toilet paper and use brown ink. Because when you write it down on toilet paper in brown ink, there is an association made of the other stuff which goes on toilet paper, which is also brown. Because, quite frankly, the pain of the past is shitty stuff. It stinks, it smells, it ruins your life, it takes away your happiness, means you can't have other relationships, you can't have other happiness and fun in life, you can't have success. Because that's why it's shitty stuff, the pain of your past. So write it down on toilet paper in brown ink. Now there's one thing you always know about toilet paper, if it's got any brown stuff on it, you never fold it up and put it in your pocket to reuse it later on. Even despite the difficult financial times, no one in your company or office insists you use both sides of the toilet paper to save the forests. Even if you've only got a quarter, even a fraction, which is brown, you throw it away, don't you? How many have ever kept soiled toilet paper to use for another time? No one does. A tiny bit of brown on it, what do? Exactly. So, you've written it down on toilet paper in brown ink, and then you have to go to the special altar for letting go. So you go in the toilet, and then you don't throw it away yet, you've got to read it again from top to bottom. So keep that association that this, you know, is not the sort of stuff you should be keeping. You read it again, and then you put it in the place where it belongs, in the bowl. You can do some chanting if you wish. And then you do the letting go ceremony. You press that little button. And all this water comes and it swirls around and it goes round the bend out of your life forever. Now, you may think that's funny, but people do that and it works. It's just basic psychology. Just to say let go of the pain of the past is just, you can't do it. You need to have some sort of ceremony. Some sort of act which reinforces the psychological message of letting go. So this is a very rich association. Brown ink, toilet paper, means it's the sort of stuff you should not be keeping. Take it to the toilet, read it again, reinforcing that this is pain, this is shitty stuff, I shouldn't have this in my life, it happened, it's gone, it needs to be thrown away. And then you put it in the bowl and you watch it as it goes down. And because you're letting it go and you're seeing it vanish from your life, there's a really good chance that that physical message goes into your mind and you let go of it emotionally as well. That's a toilet paper method. No, I invented this stuff. Because, you know, Mark, I said the other day that I was in Google last week, Google headquarters, and Facebook headquarters as well. You live a really cool life as a Mark. You get to go to places you guys cannot go to. And I was teaching people this. You know, this is why monks, we live outside the box, therefore we can see outside the box. We get all these inventive ways of dealing with these psychological problems, and all these psychologists, they write it down, they charge you for it. But, you know, this actually works. You know, with any type of letting go of the pain of the past, you've got to do something, not just think about it. Some ceremony, some act, and that's a very rich act to take it to the toilet and throw it away. It's much better than Ajahn Chah just throwing a stick into the forest. Give it a try. There may be many stuffed up toilets in Hong Kong. It may cost a lot for the plumber, but it's worth it. Thank you for your time. Who were in Hong Kong? Who were in Hong Kong is a good place to find help and support with mindfulness and meditation. I'm not practical enough to do it by myself. Thanks and blessings. But it's not expensive, is this? It is true that because this is very powerful, it becomes very expensive. But look, a very good way of doing this is get onto the internet. That meditation which I just taught you this morning, it's already been recorded. It's recorded on my website as well, and on other websites. You can get these guided meditations. You can get it on your smartphone. It doesn't cost anything if you get it from the right place. And then when you want to sort of do some mindfulness meditation to be able to relax and let go, you know, put in your sort of buds and just play it to yourself. It's like you've got, you know, the monk, the nun, the teacher, whoever it happens to be, the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh sitting next to you, talking to you. Which means it actually guides you into the deep meditations. It's true, if you do it yourself, you keep forgetting. But, you know, because of great technology, you can download it free of charge. And just on your smartphone, you find the ones which you like, which really work for you, and then you have it there at any time. You know, you feel you need to do some meditation to relax, to let go, you know, just turn it on, put the buds in the ear, listen to it, and it really, really, really works. Later on, when you get used to it, you know, you don't need the recording anymore. So it's called the guided meditations. And there's some people, they sell this stuff for a huge amount. They make fortunes. And it's something, because I was given these teachings for free, and I don't feel it's right to charge for it. You know, because I wasn't charged for it, and I like to give it out for free. One of the troubles is, though, you know, that this person, they called some time ago, many years ago, and they said, "Oh, we hear you teach meditation." I said, "Yes, I teach meditation." And they said, "How much do you charge?" And I said, "Nothing." And they said, "Well, you can't be any good then." And hung up the phone. So those things actually happen. People think the more you charge, the better it is. So these days, I never say we don't charge anymore. So these days, if a person rang up like that again, and say, "We hear you teach meditation," I should say, "Yes, I do. How much do you charge?" I say, "It is priceless." And that's such a beautiful word, instead of saying nothing, saying it's priceless, which it is. So that's actually how you can get it for free. If not healing schizophrenia patient with conventional way, like giving medication or counseling, in what way mindfulness helps them from the suffering if their symptoms are uncontrollable? That's a very deep question, because it's because you try and control it that you get tense, that you actually trigger the schizophrenic episodes. Now look, there's, because I'm a Buddhist monk and because I actually ordain other monks, I always thought that the one person who I wouldn't want to ordain as a monk and who is has a difficult time meditating is someone with schizophrenia. Because sometimes their delusions can be enhanced and magnified by meditation. Until this one fellow came along, And this is what his mindfulness was like. He was so aware of his mental state, he could see these episodes happening before they really occurred. And he was that aware of his mental world. He could see himself getting tense, and he could catch the schizophrenic episode before it caught him, and he could take another path. Now, he is now a monk. Many years he's been with me now. I haven't unleashed him onto the world yet, but he's going to be a great teacher. He's a clinical schizophrenic. And no one would ever know he's living this beautiful, happy life as a monk. And, you know, he's just a beautiful, lovely, kind, wise fellow. And he uses meditation, his mindfulness, to live an incredibly rich, fulfilling life, in spite of that condition. Some of his doctors keep saying he's a special case. I don't know how he's done this. They've done research on him, because no one's ever seen this happening before. So what he's actually doing, the mindfulness is like, I call it like walking in the jungle at night. Now, there are snakes out there. And if you step on a snake, you're going to get bitten and very, very badly ill. So what do you do when the snake's on the path? You are on the lookout for them. You're not sort of listening to your iPod or just doing a mobile phone. You're not texting when the snake's around. You're really looking. Because they're dangerous. And that means you always see them in plenty of time to avoid stepping on them, which means you never get bitten. And that's precisely what he does. He's on the watch out, you know, for the triggers of schizophrenic episodes. He sees them before they catch him, before they bite him. So he avoids them. And so I was not so impressed with his mindfulness and the way he uses it. And this is actually how people can treat such complaints, ailments. There was another monk, now he died some years ago. He was in the Vietnam War as a U.S. Marine. He was part of a street gang in New York, and he would be going around in the gangs with motorbike chains. He called it playing for keeps. This was a really nasty, bad guy. He was tough. And he joined the U.S. Marines. He joined up to get tougher. You know, this is the sort of stupid, macho, mean-spirited guy he was. But when he was in some firefight in Vietnam, he got shot in the back of the head. And he had this big cavity in the back of his head. And that, you know, knocked some sense into him. And so, you know, he stopped his violent ways and became a monk, but you know, every now and again he would have epileptic fits, you know, because of the brain damage. But then, you know, he was mindful enough, you know, he could see the causes of these fits before they happened. These epileptic fits, they didn't just come out of the blue. You know, they had the sort of the lead up to it. Most people weren't aware enough to see, you know, what happened just before you had the fit. But he was aware enough, he could see it, you know, catch it earlier and earlier and earlier, until he always caught it that early, he never had any more fits. When he saw it coming, he could go on another path and avoid sort of the epilepsy. These examples of what I have seen in my life, where people have used mindfulness, awareness of the body, awareness of the mind, you can see what's happening. As for me, you know, that this is my 64th year, and I think it's such a long time since I've been sick. I think it's almost 23 years ago now since I had to go see a doctor. And of course I had my food poisoning, but that was only 20 minutes. And sometimes, you know, I wonder why, you know, I don't get flus, I don't get colds, you know, I work very hard. And one of the reasons is that I'm so aware now of my body. Now, through loads of meditation, I know when my body's out of balance. Now, before the flu actually hits, you know, before, you know, the dengue fever really gets into you, whatever it is, you know, and I notice my body tells me, take a rest, and I do take that rest. I'm so aware of the body, you can feel it way before, you know, you get to that stage where the symptoms of disease actually manifest. And that's actually some of the things I was teaching earlier. There was something like breast cancer. Now, before it actually developed, you can feel there's something wrong there somewhere. And you can relax, rest, and actually heal it. Now, the power of meditation and mindfulness to heal things is enormous. There's many people There's one person I was just talking about. He comes every year to see me to give a big donation because he had stage 4 lung cancer, and you know, the teachings I gave him cured him for remission. So he comes every year to give a donation. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for another year of life. He should be dead. There's another person that he had psoriasis all over his body. It was the grossest thing I'd seen. He came to one of my meditation retreats wearing a rubber face mask. I thought he was some weirdo, some like SMM freak or something, some sexual deviant. Because, you know, it's rubber. We all come in to meditate with a rubber face mask on. And he said that, you know, he actually lifted a bit up. His whole face, he opened up his shirt, lifted up his trousers. His whole body, every inch of skin was covered with this incredibly irritating rash. And he said, this is to stop me scratching the skin off my face. And this poor guy, you know, this is one of the worst cases of suffering I've seen. Because this was 24 hours a day. And, you know, he'd gone to the doctor, been medicated, psychologist, psychiatrist, nothing had worked. He was trying meditation, the last throw of the dice. You know, it's almost suicidal, because you can't stand that. It's all the time. But, you know, he was wearing the face mask. He came to check in. He said, look, if I don't even last 5 minutes, it's nothing to do with you. It's just, my whole body is just so irritating and itchy and yucky. And he lasted 9 days of my meditation retreat, and it was wonderful to see him afterwards. Because he came out, he didn't have his face mask on, his skin was really clear. He opened up his shirt with pride, lifted up his trousers. Look! He had a band of a rash about 2 inches around each ankle. He said, that's it. Everything else is gone. Thank you so much. Another guy, he came in my retreat, and when he started meditating, after the first day, people complained because he was breathing very loud. So on the questions, said, Ajahn Brahm, can you please tell people to breathe quietly? And then I had to tell them that this fellow has this huge tumor in his sinus. You know, this is his last throw of the dice. The doctors have given up on him, sent him home to die, decided to try meditation just in case. And for 9 days, nothing worked. The final day, just when I was leaving, he came up to me and said something strange had happened. He was meditating, you know, breathing through his mouth as usual, and he heard a pop. That's how he described it, a pop. And he could breathe through his nose, but only for about 2 or 3 minutes. Then the tumor closed up again. But that actually gave him a lot of encouragement. Personally, I thought it was too late. He left it, you know, way too late to get any relief. But as these things happen, a couple of years later, I was teaching in Sydney. This guy comes up to me and says, do you remember me? Please don't do that to me. Because I go around the world, I see thousands of people. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I look at you, yeah, I remember your face. Where was I? I don't remember your name. So, you know, he said this, and I was honest. I said, no, I don't remember you. Who the hell are you? And he says, I was that guy. He said, I carried on meditating, the tumor just vanished. And I'm going, spending the rest of my life just teaching other people how to do this. And that was just so pleasing. And this is actually what the mindfulness and relaxation can do. Huge health benefits. Because again, as someone said, many of these diseases are stress-related. But please, because I was just talking, I said, it's been 25 years to this cancer center, and the head of it, a good fellow, Ross Taylor, he asked me a question the last time. He said, what do you think about these people fighting their cancers? And I said, look, quite frankly, I think that's the wrong way of dealing with them. There's so many people, you read it in the newspapers, I'm going to fight this, I'm going to beat it, it's a battle. That metaphor is not helpful, because if you fight your cancer, you'll get far too stressed. It's a battle. That's not what you do. The other way is taking away the stress, making peace with your cancer. Then it disappears. But please don't go around fighting things. The cancer came from stress. It won't get overcome with more stress. Anyway, but meditation, ooh, that's powerful. Can you tell more about the process of acceptance, especially times when we notice how we sink into our habitual patterns but are unable to stop it? How can we foster greater acceptance? Okay, I said last night, I'm really, really down and negative towards personal improvement courses. Who said you need to be improved? You are good enough. So you don't need to be improved. A lot of times when you try to improve yourself, you get worse. You try and improve your husband. He'll get worse. Honestly, you tried that before. It doesn't work. So instead of trying to improve your husband, care for him. Then he gets better. Don't cure, care. So this is the trouble with acceptance, is it's so rare, and we think if we accept the reality, it will get worse. And actually, this is counterintuitive, but it actually gets better. You make peace with things, and things become peaceful. So you've got habitual patterns, but unable to stop it. Well, don't stop it. Embrace and enjoy your stupidity. Because when you try and stop these things, they do get worse. Now, I'm sure I said this the last time I was here. It's one of the greatest similes. Here we go again, the anger-eating monster. Do you all remember that one? Very quickly, this monster, this demon, this incredibly hideous, frightening figure came into a palace while the empress was away. She was actually, you know, at this place doing a mindfulness course. And while she was away, this hideous, frightening monster came into her palace. And she was the monster was so frightening, so bad looking, that all of the security, which was supposed to be looking after the place, they went, vanished, hid under the tables, you know, hid behind the pot plants. Because they didn't want to challenge this huge, violent looking creature. And that allowed the monster to walk right into the center of the palace and sit on the empress's throne. And at that, they couldn't stand it anymore. Security came out and said, move! You can't stay in there. You'll be in big trouble if you don't move now. And at that, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more frightening, more smelly, more dangerous. And that made all the people in the palace, even the ministers, even the waiters and the cooks, more angry. They came out with their kitchen knives. If you don't move, your butt will carve it out. But every unkind word, every angry deed, every thought of ill will, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And this had been going on a long time. When the empress came back. And when she came back and looked what was sitting on her throne, it was the ugliest slob of a slug, slimy creature you could ever imagine. And if you think that Steven Spielberg and his alien is the most frightening creature, this made Alien look like a pussycat. And the smell coming off the monster was so bad. The stench was so overpowering that even maggots crawling on the monster's skin, they threw up. They vomited. Not even maggots could stand the smell. And the reason she was empress was because she was wise. So she saw the big monster. She knew exactly what to do. She said, welcome. Thank you, monster, for coming. Why have you waited for such a long time? Has anyone got you anything to drink yet? Something to eat? And that sincere kindness, the monster shrank an inch, got less smelly, less ugly, less offensive. And at that, everybody realized their mistake. They'd been giving this monster ill will and anger. So now they decide to be kind to it. Somebody rang out for a pizza, because you can get monster-sized pizzas now. About a dozen of the security gave the big monster a foot massage. They needed about 10 people just for one toe. And they really did it with kindness. So every kind act, kind word, kind thought, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive, until the monster was back to the size when he first came in, but they kept up with the kindness until the monster was so tiny that one more act of kindness, the monster vanished completely away. And the Buddha called that an anger-eating monster. You give it anger and it gets bigger, worse, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And there's so many anger-eating monsters in our psychology. Get out of here, bad habit, you don't belong. And you find your bad habit gets worse when you try and get rid of it. So next time, all your bad habits, say, welcome, bad habit. Thank you. And then you find your bad habit gets less. It's the anger-eating monster simile. And there's many anger-eating monsters in this world. Give it anger, they get much worse. Give it kindness, they get better. I was telling people, there's a nice story from my home country, Australia. There's this one indigenous kid who was always getting into trouble, robbing, stealing, drinking alcohol, sniffing glue. He's only about 13 or 14. Always in trouble. And the judge, you know, was about to sentence him for another stealing or robbery or whatever it was. And he said, look, you know, I've seen you so many times before. Sending you into juvenile prison is not helping you at all. So look, what would you really want? What do you dream of in life? What would you really aspire to? What would you really want? And this young 14 or 15 year old delinquent said, well, what I'd really like is a bicycle. And the judge said, okay, if you keep your nose clean for 6 months, I'll buy you one out of my own pocket. And he meant that. And the kid knew it. So he made sure he was a good kid, never got into trouble for 6 months. And the judge gave him the bike. The judge got into trouble because you're not allowed to do that, according to law. But he did it anyway. And he wrote about it. Now the kid is married with a good job. He started his own business, having a wonderful life. Just one simple act of kindness changed the kid's life. Anger, ill will, punishment makes things worse. So whatever your bad habit is, celebrate it. It's who you are. Be kind to it. And then you find it softens and disappears. You know what my bad habit is? I tell bad jokes. So here is the latest bad joke. Okay. If you listened on YouTube, you might have heard this, but if you don't listen to me on YouTube, this was an indigenous community in Australia. And the mother had three sons. And she named her first and eldest son Foot. Foot, yeah. And the next son, according to tradition, she called Footfoot. And the third son, you probably guessed it, was called Footfootfoot. And so the three children, Footfootfoot and Footfootfoot, they grew up, you know, in the sort of the bush of Australia, you know, hunting, swimming, playing around together, having a wonderful time, always being close. And when eventually Foot became 21, he went to his mother and said, look, I've never been to the city before. I spent all my time in the, you know, the deserts and the forests by the rivers and lakes. And I want to go and see a city for the first time. Mum said, no, it's too dangerous in there. You don't know what to do out there. He said, I've got it all planned, Mum. I'm going to take my younger brother, Footfoot. So with Footfoot and Foot, we should be okay when we get to Perth. We look after one another. So eventually the mother agreed. So Footfoot and Foot went on the bus. And after a while, they came to the city of Perth. And as soon as they got outside the bus, Footfoot, he found a discarded hamburger on the ground, a McDonald's. And he'd never seen one of these before. He thought it was like something in the bush you could just pick up and eat. But no, Footfoot, you know, was about to eat the hamburger, and his older brother said, Foot, no, he said, I better try it first. So, Footfoot, you give the hamburger to me. So, Foot ate the hamburger, and he didn't realize it was dirty, it was old, and he got sick straight away. And so Footfoot had to take his older brother Foot to the hospital, and they went into the hospital, and the doctors had to take one look at Foot, realized he was very sick, and so actually took him into the surgery, but unfortunately the surgery didn't work, and Foot died. And so Foot had to sort of call up his younger brother, Foot, and tell his mother, I'm sorry that Foot died. And so that they had to arrange the funeral service, and they took the body. Foot accompanied his older brother, Foot, back up to the bush in Western Australia. And there they did a ceremony, and so Foot and Foot's mum were crying their eyes out. But after a while, you know, they got rid of their grief. They went past it. They got through it. And then Foot went to his mother again and said, Mum, I was only in the city for 5 minutes. I spent most of the time in the hospital looking after my brother who had died. Can I go back to the city again? His mum said, of course you can't go. He said, look, I'll take my younger brother, Foot, because Foot will look after Foot, and Foot will look after Foot. We'll look after each other. We'll be fine. We promise we won't eat any hamburgers this time. And his mum said, of course you can't go. Why not, Mum? And here is the punchline. You can't go because I've got one foot in the grave already. So that is my addiction. That is the telling stupid jokes. And I'm not going to get rid of that addiction or that stupid tendency anytime soon. How to become a monk? What should one consider? Any practical advice to make the decision, please? Yes, just do it. People think too much. And look, it's very difficult in Hong Kong these days. Sometimes you get a career and you get sacked or the company goes bust. People lay off workers because the economy is not going well. If you become a monk, I guarantee job security. You won't get the sack, or nuns as well. We've got nuns now. Absolute job security. Job fulfillment is incredible, the fulfillment you get as a monk. Now, the pay's not good, but the retirement benefits are out of this world. It's a great life as a monk. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for coming. I'm here because I watched your talk on Google, on YouTube, and thought it was really cool. I just started reading your book during lunch and read the part about building your brick wall for your monastery. Did you build a brick wall wearing your monk's robe? Actually, we take off the outer robe and just have the inner robe when we do any work. Because if you use this robe when you're climbing ladders, it would be really, really dangerous. But this robe has other uses. You know, it's great sort of, you know, it's covering you up when you're giving a talk. And I use it as a bed sheet, you know, in the evening. And what was it, last October, and I was flying to Europe to give a series of talks, and that was just after that plane, was it MH17 or something, got shot down over Ukraine. And my disciples, they wanted to stop me going. They said it's too dangerous because we can't afford to lose you if you get shot down. And I said, look, I've got it all planned. Because if I get shot down, you know, over Ukraine or somewhere, I'll just take off my robe, hold the four corners, and it's a parachute. But they say, what happens if you get shot down over Ukraine? By, you know, because it goes a long way before, you know, it actually sort of lands or crashes. What happens if you have to land in Syria? Because number one, you're white. Number two, you're obviously not a Muslim. So, you know, you're an infidel. You'll be the first one for the chop. I said, I've got that figured out as well. Because with a robe like this, I'll just do a little slit over here. Put it over here. And this will be my burqa. And they won't know who's underneath. So this can be a burqa, a parachute, a robe. It's very practical. So that's what I said. That's basically, stop worrying about things. The chance of you getting shot down is absolutely zero. Okay. I did build the brick wall, but not wearing the robe. Other than taking a shower, do you do everything in your monk's robe? Hope this isn't a silly question. Of course, I take this off to shower. What else do I do? Oh, look, you know that once, you know, this is the last time I was sick. I went to hospital. That was 23 years ago. 23 years ago? About 23 years ago, the last time I went to hospital. And you know what it's like, you go to hospital in the West, you've got to wear pyjamas. So when I checked in, they said, wear your pyjamas. I say, I'm a monk, I don't have any. But you have to wear pajamas. And I look, honestly, this is what I said. I looked at them and said, it's these robes or nothing. Take your choice. That's what I said. And I said, okay, you can wear your robes. So really good fun. So you have a lot of fun, isn't it? How to stay awake when doing meditation so I easily fall asleep? Thanks. Okay, now that's a very nice question. When your mindfulness gets very strong, you know, you will notice how tired you are. I've been telling a lot of people this. Last night I said, the biggest cause of emotional distress, physical sickness, and problems in relationships all come to tiredness. I'm being honest here, being frank. Everyone in this room is so tired. You're exhausted. But you've gotten used to it, so you don't notice it. You work so hard, and you don't know how to rest. Weekends, you do stuff. Instead of learning how just to sit back and do absolutely nothing, to really relax. It's one of the skills people have lost, just to hang out, do nothing. We always have this list of things we have to tick off. And relaxing is probably, no, not even on the list. It's on the bottom of the bottom list to get to when you've finished everything else. And because people are tired, that's why, number one, they get physically ill. Number two, they have emotional problems like depression. You get so tired, so worn out, you get to this low level and you can't get out again. And number three, that we get angry at the people we love. These people you love, these are your children, your spouse. It's not them. You've got no resilience left at all. You're just so exhausted, so tired. Which is one of the reasons I've been going around Hong Kong and also other places, giving you, that person who can't get a job, I will give you a business, which is guaranteed to make you a lot of money. Get a sleep retreat. A place where you can go to, now maybe just across the border in mainland China, or just very simple place, nice accommodation, quiet, a very nice bed, no counselors, no therapists, just a bed with breakfast, lunch and dinner, whatever time you want it, middle of the night, it doesn't care, so you can just catch up on your sleep with nothing to do. No emails or SMSs, from your boss are possible. Just you can catch up on your sleep for 3 days. Nothing else. If there was such a place available, how many here would want to go? As I said last night, that's the market. It's out there. Because a lot of time people are tired, they know they're tired and exhausted, and you send yourself off to a sleep retreat for 3 or 4 days, just to relax and rest whenever you want to go to bed, day or night, nap after nap after nap to catch up. You'll become much healthier physically. And also that, you'll find you're happier and you have more resilience. You don't get upset. No more road rage. No more stuff about sort of getting angry at your kids. And you'll also be happier with yourself. Your emotional health, relationship health, physical health would improve enormously. That's something which I have seen and which I'm really concerned about. And about half, if not more, cancers will be stopped if you could just relax and rest and get rid of that really chronic tiredness. And what happens when you meditate, you are letting go and your brain is saying, at last, I can take a break. So if you do get sleepy while you're doing any type of meditation, please, for goodness sake, let yourself go to sleep. Don't fight it. This is natural. It shows you're tired. It's an opportunity to catch up on your sleep. So please do it. When I teach meditation retreats, I tell for the first 3 days, sleep as much as you like. Really get into it. Because I always remember this one executive from Sydney. I told her that she actually arrived late, middle of the night, because she was trying to fix up all the loose ends before she went on her meditation retreat. And when she actually came and she heard this, she was so happy. She got up just before breakfast, and after breakfast she went to bed again. She got up for lunch, after lunch went to bed again. And she slept for about 3 days. And after the third day, you know, she topped up. She was okay. Then she started to meditate. And, you know, she was way behind others on the fourth day. She caught up by the sixth or seventh day. By the end of the 9-day retreat, she was like my star meditator. And I always praised her. She said, that is the way to meditate. Look after your body, first of all. Relax, rest, get your body healthy again, energized. Then you find that when your body is fit and healthy, it's so easy to be mindful, to be awake. You've got to rest and look after your body, first of all. Otherwise, you know, you can't force this. This is a natural process of waking up and being here. The other thing with mindfulness is, why is it that people find it difficult to be here? And this is the reason why. It's my simile of the two women inviting you out for a cup of coffee. So, you free afternoon, you receive a call from one of your friends, and she says, hey, how about coming out for a cup of coffee? You say, yeah, that's fine, because I want to take you to this coffee shop which I like. I don't want to go to your coffee shop. I want you to come to my coffee shop. And, you know, the short black, Sarah, is so delicious. I know you like your lattes, but they're bad for your health. Have a short black with me. And instead of those chocolate chip muffins you like, now we're going to have this biscuit, you know, which I like. And we're going to sit in the corner. I know you like sitting out on the veranda, but I don't like sitting on the veranda. We're going to sit in the corner. And I know you always like talking about Buddhism, but I want to talk about politics. So we're going to talk about politics, okay? And we're going to be there for 1 hour and 10 minutes, because that's all the time I have. So I'll see you there soon, okay? Now, if someone invites you out for a coffee, and they tell you where to go, what to drink, what to eat, what to talk about, where to sit, are you going to want to go with a person like that? So this person thinks, oh, I'm terribly sorry, I just remembered, I've got to go to the dentist this afternoon. Oh, I'm sorry. And you hang up. 2 minutes later, you get another call on your phone. And this other person said, hey, do you want to come out for a cup of coffee? Say, oh, I've got a dentist appointment, I'm sorry. Oh, that's just a shame. Because I know that coffee shop you keep talking about, which makes this delicious latte. I want to try that. And, you know, you say it's so wonderful sitting out on the street. I want to do that as well. I've never done that before. And you've always been talking about, you know, this Buddhism stuff. You know, I usually like politics, but I'm really interested. Can we talk about your Buddhism? And when somebody and you say these chocolate chip muffins are there, are really to die for. You know, okay, I want to try one. And when somebody rings up and wants to go to your coffee shop and drink the coffee you like, sit where you like, eat what you like, and also talk those things which interest you, would you want to go? So you say, oh, I'm cancelling the dentist appointment, I'm coming. And you've only got 1 hour and 10 minutes, but you find you spend all afternoon there. Why? Because people are being kind to you. Now, in this simile, you know, the person who calls up is you, and you are your mind. Sometimes we control our mind so much and say, right, you're now going to meditate, okay? Sit and do the scanning of your body, or watch your breath, or be mindful, okay? Be mindful! And you've done that so many times to your mind that as soon as your mind sees you coming, it's off. The reason why it's restless, it's trying to escape. From guess who? You. You've given it such a bad time in the past, controlling it, telling it off. So in order to be mindful, I developed a technique where you sit down and you ask your mind, when you close your eyes, mind, what do you want to do? You don't tell the mind what to do. You ask the mind, mind, what do you want to do right now? If you want to think, fine, off you go thinking. You want to have a sexual fantasy? Off you go. Have a sexual fantasy. If you want to have a nap, have a nap. If you're kind to your mind like that, you'll find your mind likes to stay with you. No longer will your mind be restless. Your mind will hang out with you. It'll make it so easy to be mindful, to be here, to be with someone who likes you and you like them. I've been chilling out with my mind for such a long time now. We are the best of friends. We understand each other. Which means that when I close my eyes, it's like my mind says, hey, you're back again. Okay, let's hang out together. So my mind doesn't wander off. It doesn't try to escape from me, which is a cause of restlessness. Too much thinking, simply because your mind is trying to escape. So I just tell my mind, well, what do you want to do? A lot of the time I said, okay, we're just going to hang out. We're going to meditate together. So please, don't be control freak. Control freak tires the mind, tires the body, stresses you out. Be a kindness freak. Which is one of the reasons why on these retreats, these days, this is not a day of mindfulness. This is a day of kindfulness. Yeah. Please, when you meditate, include kindness. Without kindness, there's no peace in this world. Be kind to your mind. So if it wants to fall asleep, fine, off you go, fall asleep. I'll be here when you wake up, mind. Good night. That is the way I meditate. And it works. That's where I teach. And it works. I've got a very good track record. So be kind to your body and kind to your mind. And then you find it so easy to be peaceful. Okay. Those are the questions. It's now 2 o'clock. So we can do a little bit of meditation again. So this time, what time? We're going to do like a being in the present moment meditation this time. My simile of the two shopping bags. So, first of all, we can all stand up. Anyone who wants to go to the letting go room, very quickly. You know the letting go room? There's two over there called the toilets. And just stretch the body a little bit, and then we can do the meditation. So when you're ready, please sit down. And when you're ready, just close your eyes. Some people are going to be coming in, going out, but don't worry. It's just noise. Close your eyes and become aware of your body sitting here and ask your body, body, what do you need to become more comfortable within reason? Sometimes this is a very good technique for arousing mindfulness. Ask. When you ask a question of the body gives you an answer. It may be you need to scratch your ear or something. Or you need to adjust, you know, your bottom. Asking a question is a way of arousing mindfulness. So I'm asking my body, how can you become more comfortable? You can ask your legs, are you comfortable? What can I do to make you more comfortable? Whatever your legs answer, please do it. Ask your bottom, are you comfortable on the cushion or the seat, or do you need to fidget a little bit I'll ask your back. Back, are you nice? Do you need to be stretched, to be loosened? Back, what do you need to be comfortable? Then ask your shoulders. Shoulders, what do you need? Shoulders, are you comfortable? Because when you ask a certain part of the body, your mindfulness goes there. And you soon get an answer to that question, what to do. Hands, are you comfortable in that position? Or do you want to move? And head, what do you need to be more comfortable? You can see this is a way of arousing mindfulness of your body. So your body is nice and comfortable. And now you ask your mind, how are you feeling? Are you tired? Are you bored? Are you restless? Mind, how are you right now? It's like asking a good friend. Sometimes your good friend may appear to be happy, but until you ask him, you don't realize the problems they have. So now you're asking your mind, how are you? What do you need? Because this is not just being mindful, it's being kindful. You care enough about your body, you care enough about your mind to inquire as to its well-being and to heed the answer your body and mind gives you. If your ear needs a scratch, please be kind enough to scratch your ear. If your mind is a bit tired, just let it rest in some dullness. Whatever your mind wants, be kind to it. And if you continue to be kind to your own mind, your relationship to your mind gets so good, your mind always wants to stay with you. Just like the good friend and you hang out in a coffee shop for hours, having a wonderful time together, because you literally care for one another instead of trying to control each other. So just hang out with your mind for a few minutes, like you're having a cup of coffee together. Just ask your mind, how are you going? Mind, you've been enjoying today so far? Mind, are you tired? Mind, have you heard anything interesting today? So when you talk to your mind like that, you are actually establishing mindfulness. Until you can become aware of your mind without any questions. One of the troubles with meditation is we waste too much time just thinking over the past, which can never be changed. And never think that you can learn from the past. We learn much more from the present, from now, than we will ever learn from the past. Learn from the present, not from the past. And as far as worrying about the future is concerned, please understand that now, this moment, is where your future is being made. Now is the only time you can ever do anything for your future. So if you care about your future, please put all of your attention into the place where it's being made now. Just being in the present. And to some this may be difficult. So I invite you to join in this mental exercise. You imagine you are carrying two heavy shopping bags. One in your left hand, one in your right hand. And they're very heavy. And you've been carrying them for such a long time that you imagine that your arms and shoulders ache because they are tired. And the two heavy shopping bags. And in this exercise, you imagine looking at the shopping bag in your left hand. On the outside, you can see the four letters P-A-S-T, the past. Because in that shopping bag are all your memories, all the tragedies, all the great moments of your past, good and bad. And you've been carrying them for such a long time that your heart is tired. It aches. It's lost its energy. And then you imagine the shopping bag in your right hand, just as heavy, maybe more so. And on the outside of that bag, you can imagine reading the letters F-U-T-U-R-E. That represents your future. Because in that shopping bag are all your plans and dreams, anxieties, fears, hopes, all mixed up in that shopping bag of the future. And the trouble is you've been holding that and carrying that too long. That also makes your heart weak. It tires out the mind. Because you've been holding it for too long. So you feel the weight of those two shopping bags which represent your past and your future. And then you imagine focusing on the shopping bag in your left hand, the past, and how heavy it is, and how difficult it is to keep bearing that from moment to moment throughout your day, throughout your life. So now, you imagine your spine leaning to the left, allowing you to lower the shopping bag in the left hand as you bend your knees, lowering the shopping bag in the left hand representing your past until it meets the ground. When it meets the ground, there is no more burden. The weight is now borne by the floor, which allows you to uncurl the fingers from the handle of the bag. Straighten your spine, lift up your legs, your knees, straighten your legs, so your left hand and arm can recover as it hangs loosely by your side. By putting down that shopping bag, you are letting go of your past. And then you imagine the shopping bag in your right hand, the future. Your fears, plans, anxieties, hopes. So heavy to carry that all the time. And now you imagine leaning to the right, bending your legs, and lowering the shopping bag representing your past, your future, to the ground. When it meets the floor, the burden, the weight vanishes. And then you move your hand away from that bag. Straighten your legs and your back. You've let go of the future. So your right hand and arm can now also recuperate. And before you finish this exercise, You imagine just looking down at those two shopping bags, one holding your past, the other one worries about the future. You put them down, and you are standing in this wonderful space between the past and the future, the place we call now, the only time you ever had. And you deserve this rest, this place of peace. You've let go. And enjoy the freedom of having no worries about the past, no concerns about the future, just for another 15 or 20 minutes. Those bags, unfortunately, will be there for you afterwards to pick up and carry. But for now, you rest. You deserve it. You need it. So how do you feel right now? Please be kind to this feeling. This is your mind right now. Be gentle with her. Don't look at her like a slave, like a maid, to order her out. If you are kind to the present moment will stay with you. Be gentle with her. And if there are any thoughts come into your mind, please imagine that you're standing back from the thoughts, like watching the thoughts play out on a TV screen. And you're watching them from a distance. Not entangled, not engaged, not involved, but detached physically. Then you find the thoughts will not entangle you. You won't get pulled into the screen. You're mindful. You're at peace. And the great thing is that peace deepens and grows and develops.
letting go of the past, not picking up the future, just being here, being at peace with this moment. How do you feel right now? How peaceful are you? Be aware not of the content of your mind, but the quality of your mind, especially the quality of peace. When you are mindful of the degree of peace, it can give you feedback. You find out what you need to make the part of the mind even more peaceful. getting close to the end of the meditation now. So I invite you to take a deep in-breath, and on the out-breath open your eyes. When you finish the meditation, if you can, make a smile. Simple thing to do, but it makes me feel happier because I have to face all of you. Very good. So that's up to about 2:30, an hour and a half little session there with the questions and a bit of meditation at the end. So now I think it's a good time. Do we take a tea break now? Makes sense? So we'll take a tea break for sort of half an hour. We can come back. What, is that too long? 20 minutes? 20 minutes? Half an hour? 20 minutes. Okay, 20 minutes tea break and come back at, what time does it say there? Just about 5 to 3. For the last session, the last push to peace of mind. Very good. So, tea break, coffee break. What else break can you have? Water break? Juice break? Yes. Thank you. If anyone has any more questions they'd like to ask, there's still some paper over there with pens, and you can ask the questions over there for the last session.
Book in, and it's first come, first served. So it's a bit tough to get in, but if you get on the website, no reason why you can't. So get on the website.
If I wanted to stay in the Bodhiyana monastery longer for the spiritual practice,
that's more difficult because there's only 3 rooms and they get booked up a long time in advance. So if you want to get on the retreat, you can email the caretaker, and that's caretaker@bsw.org. The details will be on there. If you want to stay at Bodhiyana Monastery, you have to email the guest mark. Yeah, guest mark. Yeah. So you can see it on there somewhere on the website. So it's difficult to get on there because it's still popular. Sorry. When we have the retreats, all booked online, they fill up in about 2 minutes. You've got to be quick. Be fast. Okay, that's done. Okay.
Yeah. When you meditate, when you feel sleepy enough, can you just aware that the sleepiness?
Yeah.
Then you just come back?
Yeah. After a while, if you fight it, it lasts a long time. If you relax and just let it be, you find it doesn't last that long. After a while, the sleepiness vanishes.
Yeah.
That's the best way.
Okay, thank you.
Very good.
Can
you can encourage them. You can make it easy for them. Like, if you can, we'll record some of these little exercises and just give it to her on a little USB stick or something. Then plug it into your computer, put it in your iPhone, and you can actually do some meditation.
Okay.
I see the problem is question. Either she goes to sleep for a whole long day or actually the worst scenario is that she kept herself in the toilet for a bathroom for a whole day.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can
it's a difficult
take
thing.
A shower for that long. But she's sleepy.
Yeah. I think what was really happening there, it got to the point, it'd be wonderful if they could have preached it with the mindfulness meditation at the early stages of it.
Yeah,
it's gone a bit far now, so you have to keep up with the medication and do the meditation alongside as a complementary therapy until the meditation gets so strong you can probably overcome the medication later on. But you have to do both.
But how do I encourage
who did she have faith in? Did she have faith in a doctor?
No.
Did she have faith in a mother or father or a friend?
No.
Because
a friend. Because always faith.
Yeah. Does it have faith in you? Confidence in you?
No.
Yeah. That's the thing. You have to find out who will influence her. And because it's so hard to convince a person to do anything. They have to be encouraged. And when they get encouraged, influence, then you know, you can actually suggest that to her. Other than that, the only thing you can do is leave these things in the house, little books on meditation, and hopefully that one day she'll pick one up and read it.
Well, she just, when she's there at home, she just read for the whole day or pick up for the whole day.
Yeah. Okay.
She just make more
bathrooms in the house.
Yeah, her house has got four bathrooms.
Okay, let's say you've got other people, other bathrooms to use. Not as much as you can do. Alright. Yeah, sure. Very good. How are you enjoying it? Very good.
Why didn't you come to a channel meanwhile?
Why? Because I've got to go to so many other places. I only came back from the United States, San Francisco, on Friday. I had 2 days in my monastery.
Yeah,
then come back over here. And when I go back, I have to go to Indonesia. And after I go to Indonesia, I have to go to Thailand. And after I go to Thailand, I have to go to, Hong Kong. No, to Korea. After I go to Korea. So many places I have to go to.
No jet lag?
Yeah, jet lag, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
I come from Milan, you know, from you.
Ah, very good.
Yeah,
and I learned actually through the YouTube channel.
I think the meditation talk
that you
was quite different from Muslim, the Buddhism
time
in China.
Yeah. So that's why I came all the way from Australia. You only came from just a little way away. So I came most of the way, so fair. Okay, well, enough questions. Why the paper? Why the pen? Wow. Okay. The questions are good because they're saying what.
Very good.
It's not good to say.
They have two tea bags.
Ah, good.
4 bags of sugar. I thought this is sweet enough for you.
Ah, that's nice.
You sure?
That's pretty.
Okay. Now this is for water.
Okay. Okay. Okay, come on. Please, no more questions. Okay. Okay. Yes, I can do that, yeah. Here we go. Very good.
I like your story.
Very good. Okay, here we go. I may not be able to do all the questions, but I'll give it a try. You've got a pen. You have a pen.
me when I was young. I got a pen. I've got a pen.
Imagine it's coming out on the screen. It's not really good. Yes, I know I've been coming a long time. We used to live in Melbourne. In the south of the whole West Australia. And I know all the families there. Well. Yes, I'm going there next May. To a retreat. Yes. Yeah. Coming by, yes. Yes.
Okay, there's a lot of questions here, so I better get started. Oh, that one hasn't been answered yet. Those have been answered on there. Yes. Okay, here we go. I'll try and be quick with these questions. Terrible stage fright. I'm a professional singer-songwriter with... terrible stage fright. Do you have any suggestions on meditation to help us embrace our gifts without fear, so we are channels for these gifts? Yeah, look at me. I have stage fright too. No, of course I don't. But you know, one of the scariest things is to do live TV. Because if it's live TV and it goes all over the country, like I've done in several countries, if you just put your finger in your nose, everybody sees it. So it's very, very scary if you go on live TV. But one good piece of advice is that, you know, whenever I give a talk, I make sure I enjoy myself. And if I enjoy myself, I notice you cannot have fun and fear at the same time. If you're enjoying yourself, you don't have any being scared. And that's really important. So just go out there. If you're a singer-songwriter, enjoy your music. Have fun. And if you have fun, you relax, you perform well, and everything goes very well in your life. If you're going to an interview, have fun. Then you don't get afraid. When I go to the dentist, I'm not afraid. I have fun at the dentist. Because when I'm sitting in the dentist chairs are the most comfortable in the whole world. And I sit down and relax, and I feel great. At last, no one can take a photo of me, they can't ask me to sign a book, and they can't ask any questions. And that way I have fun. You know, I tell the story, it happened in Hong Kong here. Where is it? In the Technical University, the Jockey Club Auditorium. I know, I've given a talk a couple of times there, I'm not going there this year. But after giving a talk, answering questions, signing books, having photos taken, as well as a monk, I'm a human being. I wanted to go to the toilet. And the toilet was outside the auditorium. I worked my way out. People stopped me, have a photograph, ask a question, sign a book, work myself closer, closer. And I finally got in the toilet. And as soon as I got in the toilet, this guy turned around and said, "Oh, actually, I'm broke. Can I take a photo?" Inside the toilet! There is no escape for me. It's a good story, but it's true. So always have fun no matter what you're doing. And it's also because, look, a lot of people, and I'm a monk now, I'm over 60, so I can say these things, but a lot of you guys, you see a nice girl, you want to talk to her, just have fun, and then you relax. Then you don't sort of mess up when you try and talk to a girl you really like. And so you girls, you know, you have fun too. If you see a guy you like and he won't talk to you, you go and talk to him. Just but have fun in life, because when you're fun, you relax. When you relax, you always come across as confident. And when you come across as confident, it's amazing what you can do in life. Just, I remember many, many times. I remember the time once when I was going to a conference, and afterwards, this reporter came up to me, and he wanted to ask me about shipping. You know, about sort of the economics and the future of shipping and transport in the world. I'm a monk. I don't know anything about shipping. But you know, that never stopped me. Just because you don't know anything about it, that's not going to stop me from talking about it. So I did this in-depth interview about shipping. And this was amazing. This has actually happened. It's true. At the end of the interview, you know, thank you very much. I never heard from the guy for another 3 months. And 3 months later, I happened to see him, and he said, wow, that interview you did. And I put it in my shipping magazines, and it was syndicated over every shipping magazine, major magazine in the world. And he got all these emails back, you know, from these other experts. We've never heard of this Ajahn Brahm before, but whoever he is, he certainly knows what he's talking about. And I didn't know what I was talking about at all. Made it up as I went along. But it's a confidence, you know, which got you through. So that confidence, have fun. Don't take life so seriously. And you will find that you will, you know, always do well, whether it's in music, whether it's in public speaking, whether it's talking to girls, if, you know, you want a nice girlfriend, someone you really, really, really like, whatever it is, or getting a job. And that confidence is really, really powerful. So have fun. What do stars represent? I'm in a hotel now, and when I'm staying there, it's got an extra star. Me. It used to be a 4-star hotel, now it's a 5-star hotel. So what do stars represent? I don't know. It depends. They represent what you want to represent. So if it's like a star, it can be just a sign of goodness, of kindness. So how many stars do you give me for this retreat? Yeah, it doesn't really matter. How to approach eternal life? Oh, eternal life. That'd be just such a pain. Do you really want to hear the same old stories from me for eternity? The same old jokes. No, so sometimes, you know, eternal life is really a bit silly. Because if you think of, you know, what eternity would mean, you know, after a while you get bored with anything. And so you can't have life without change. That's an important part of life. And you can't have things always the same. You know, you won't stay the same. I won't stay the same. Hong Kong will never stay the same. Because life never stands still. So don't look at eternal life, but this beautiful changing life, evolving life. And of course, you know, we will all die one day. But as long as you left the world a better place, you know, for you being here. And don't ever think that, you know, you're... Oh, somebody sent me a card with this on. You know, your success is never made. It's never represented in monuments or statues. Know that your success, your real monuments, is in the hearts of people who have known you. And the effect you've had on them. And that's the meaning of your life. And that means you live forever. Your body dies, you go on. But you know, what you've done for others will always live in their hearts. That's your eternity. Dear Ajahn, do you consider Buddhism as a religion? It is a religion for tax purposes. Yeah, it's the same in Hong Kong. You get lots of, you know, tax perks if you're a religion. So, yes, yeah, certainly for tax purposes. Do you have a view, in other words, what's your view about religion? Oh, just religion is just a way that, you know, we can understand our life. something we're committed to, which can help us. It's like some higher truth, some higher values. And one of the things I was really always surprised about is why in the biggest moments of your life, like when you get married or when you die, you know, that's when people want religion more than any other time. And I thought, why when marriage do you want sort of like a priest who's been celibate for 40 years or something to bless, you know, what is like a secular thing, like a marriage? And it took me a long time to understand that, you know, when you marry, there's something very religious about that, very spiritual, you know, very holy. Now you're committing yourself to another person. And you know, you're allowing yourself to be totally vulnerable as you give yourself, you know, to this incredible thing called a marriage. It's a spiritual thing. It's one of the reasons why that, you know, when we were just talking earlier at lunchtime with Gerald about sort of gay marriage. In many parts of the world, it's allowed. Some parts, it's not allowed. And so, well, why? You know, why allow marriage? Why do you want a gay marriage for? Just make out a contract. No, that's not what marriage is all about. There's a sense of holiness, commitment. It's a spiritual, powerful moment in your life, which is why that many people, they want to have some spiritual leader there at the time, one of the most important times in their life. Not just to give them advice, like, you know, the story of the calendar method, but it's also just, you know, to bless something and to raise it to a higher level. And I was wondering why. It's because a lot of times when you do commit to a relationship, there's a lot of selflessness there. You know, you can't do what you want to do anymore. You have to do what we want to do. There's a whole lot of letting go to a higher purpose. And that higher purpose is just a relationship. It's not about me anymore. As I often say, you've heard the story, but it really works. It's powerful. I look at the husband, first of all, the new husband, in the eye. From now on, you're a married man. You mustn't think of yourself. Yes, he says. Look at the new bride. You're a married woman. You mustn't think of yourself anymore. She smiles and says, yes. Still looking at the bride, I say, now you must not think of your husband anymore. And she gets confused. And I look at the husband, from this moment on, you must not think of her, your wife. And this is a beautiful moment because there's a pause of confusion. As they're trying to figure out, what does this crazy man mean? And then I give them the answer, and they always get it. I take them to a different level of understanding what marriage is. Now you're married, you must not think of yourself. You must not think of your partner. You must only think of us. It's us now. It's not me, it's not him, it's not her. It's us. And you can see that takes the whole relationship to a bigger level. And the only problem in the marriage, whose problem is it? Our problem. It's not his problem. It's not her problem. It's not my problem. It is our problem. And you can see that takes the whole thing to this spiritual level, which is one of the reasons why that people want to get married in a church, in a temple, or in a place which has some spiritual significance for you. I can understand why. Because it is holy. It is spiritual. So there's many, many of these things which, you know, religion actually gives you. It raises people up to a far, far higher level. And they see a bigger picture in life. And sometimes, you know what it's like in life, just the work, getting on in life, you know, solving the problems of the hospitals, the universities. It's wonderful to have a religion which sees a bigger picture. And which can help people. Now find some meaning in their life, some peace in their life. And of course religion does this, especially something like Buddhism. So it's very powerful. And you know, I still say that Buddhism is a religion. There was a big debate in the House of Lords in England many years ago. And it was basically, was Buddhism a religion? And they decided, well, it doesn't have like a creator God like many other religions, but it has everything else, and it really deserves being called a religion. So it was actually the House of Lords in the UK, they redefined religion to include Buddhism. So words, ill words, they change, they develop with usage. So most people look at Buddhism as a religion. Why not? On one hand, you feel that you are contented, but on the other hand, you are subconsciously suicidal, doing things to hurt and wishing to end one's life earlier always. What can this person do to help him or herself? The inner conflict seems to be able to end, not to be able to end, even with the meditation. Okay, if you really are contented, why do you want to sort of commit suicide? You're having a good time. And anyway, please understand that Buddhists can't commit suicide. It's impossible. Not because they're disallowed or it's illegal. It's because once they kill their body, they're still here. They get reincarnated, so you can't do it that way. Imagine that. You know, you try and commit suicide, you know, you shoot yourself, you jump off a bridge, and you're there afterwards. That's really a bummer. You try and get rid of yourself, and you're still here. You just lost your body. And so that doesn't work. Not to be recommended. Because if you were depressed before, you really are depressed afterwards. So there's many other ways to solve the problems. Just getting rid of the body is not getting rid of the problem. You know, it's not getting rid of life. You can't get rid of life that easy just by killing yourself. So, you know, the life is in the mind. It's in the heart. It's inside. It's not the body. Which is why if you can't get your heart and your mind right, just messing around with the body is not going to help at all. Killing it, doing stuff with it, harming the body, that's not going to solve the problem. So that's why a little bit of meditation, a little bit of seeing things in perspective. People get suicidal. You know that story of the two bad bricks and the wall? I wanted to destroy that wall because I could only see two bad bricks. I couldn't see the other bricks in the wall. And when I learned how to see not just my mistakes, when I saw the other things in my life, I'd never want to destroy the wall again. It was a good wall. People only want to commit suicide when they get out of perspective, they see the faults of rubbish in life, and they can't see anything else. Another story was when I was in KL, and this woman in the question time, the great question, he asked in public, she said, I caught my husband lying to me this morning, shall I divorce him? And in public she asked this. You know, put her hand up. No, not in a question like on a piece of paper. She asked it outright. My husband lied to me, should I divorce him? And ask a mug that question. So anyway, my answer was quite a really smart answer. I said, first of all, you know, what are you doing? What's your job? And she was a professor of math in the university. And I said, how long have you been married to your husband? She said, 3 years. And I saw my opportunity. I said, okay, let's do some statistics. You've been married for 3 years. Let's call that 1,000 days. Now, give or take a day here or there. And let's, for the sake of this argument, let's make an assumption that on average, over the 3 years of your marriage, your husband has said maybe 20 things to you on average each day, which could be right, which could be wrong. That's a fair assumption. So since you've been married, he said 20,000 statements to you, which could be right, which could be wrong. Now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he opens his mouth, there is a 20,000-to-1 chance on past record that he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? 20,000-to-1 is good odds. But I said it like that because why is it the one lie is all we see? And we say, I can't trust my partner anymore. He's lied. Why don't we look on the 19,999 times she's told the truth? When I said that, she said, oh, I get it. And so they're still married. One lie does not make you a liar. So put it in perspective, and then you don't get divorced. To getting divorced, look, I know this as a truth. Actually, in Australia, as I'm telling people, we don't have divorce anymore. Not in my Buddhist society. We don't call it divorce, we call it recycling. So you come out of it and say, no, you haven't done divorce, you've just recycled. If you change your partner, I don't know how many people have done this already on your second, third partner, whatever. Have you noticed something? They are all the same. you know, if you get another husband, and look, you know, you get rid of the old one, you get the new one. There's only slight differences in the model, but just they're basically the same. You know, you change your wife, get another model, usually a younger model. Yeah, it's different chassis, but the engine is exactly the same. So you might as well stick with the one you've got. You know, it's much cheaper in the long run. So anyway, the inner conflict of being subconsciously suicidal. Look at the two bad bricks in the wall story. Look at these other ways, you know, the hand right in front of you. You put the problems of your life into perspective. They're not that bad. And there's so much other beauty and happiness in life. Please look at that, and then you never ever want to kill yourself because you can't anyway. Waste of time. There are people that you like more and people that you like less. Just can't treat everyone equally. Is this something bad? No, that's naturally. But, you know, you can't treat people, you know, there's some people you like, but it depends on your job. You know, if you are like a doctor, you know, you can't sort of treat the people you like one way and the people you don't like another way. I don't like this person, I'm going to cut off this and cut off that. No, you have a like a responsibility, you know, actually to, you may not think that you like people equally, but at least you can act and speak fairly and equally to others without discrimination. Otherwise, you have to treat people equally, even though you do like some people more than others. Otherwise, have you been treated unfairly? What does it feel like? You know, when someone in authority treats someone else much better than you. What does it feel like? You know, that really sucks, that really hurts. So please don't do that to other people. How do you stay positive when life doesn't go your way? My life never goes my way. I never became a monk to sign books and have my photograph taken. That is not my way. But I realize I've got no choice. So when you've got no choice, you enjoy it. Life will never go your way, but it goes a good way, even though it's not your way. It goes life's way. So smile when life doesn't go your way. You've got no choice. You like it or lump it, as they say. Have fun with it, or suffer, suffer, suffer. It's your choice. Suffering is your choice. It's not anybody else's fault. It's not life's fault. It's just because the way, you know, you fight the impossible. So I know now, I'm going to have my photograph. I can't figure this out. I'm old. I'm fat. Why on earth do you want to make a photograph of me? Crazy. You know, the ones we had these books, I was fed up with signing them, so we had them pre-signed. You know, when they were printed, they had a signature on there. And what happened? No, we want a real signature. So I had the printed one, I had to sign above it, or below, I forget what. I just can't escape. So I can't escape, okay. So you can do whatever you want. And it's much more fun that way. Because whatever I have to do, I enjoy it anyway. So whatever you have to do. And you can put fun into absolutely anything you do. It's brilliant to be able to put fun into the most ridiculous, stupid of things, which you have to do in life. And what's a nice example? Obviously going to the doctor, having fun, laughing with the doctor, or even just thinking now, one of the great monks I knew, Dr. Kesari Dhammananda, because I go to Malaysia a lot, he was a good friend, he got cancer, he died. I remember seeing his doctor, his oncologist. The oncologist said that when he gave the final biopsy result to this monk and said, your cancer is terminal, there's nothing more we could do. You know what this monk did? He laughed. And the doctor said, he's the only person I've ever known, once they said they were terminal, laughed. That's my type of monk. But anyway, what is life? Anyway, life, as someone once said, is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. That's called life. Hello, Ajahn. If one wants to learn and be a great Buddhist, does he need to take formal training like university courses on Buddhism? Or would your YouTube videos and courses like this be enough? This is a loaded question, because there's many people here from the Center of Buddhist Society in Hong Kong University, and I'm giving a talk there this evening, so I'm going to be in big trouble whatever way I answer. So, do both. Now look, some people, they like doing the academic side. Some people, you know, more like doing the practical side. Either works, okay. So whichever way works for you. What is the difference between the mind, between difference impact on the mind? Sorry, what is the difference impact on our mind between meditation and sleep? Is sleep a substitute of meditation? No, not really. In meditation, you can really get high and blissed out. Now, on these little one-day retreats, you know, you only sort of talk a little bit about, you know, the early beginnings of meditation when you start to get, you know, just mindful. But I was going to say that when you add stillness to the mindfulness, your mindfulness really grows in power. It's one of the teachings on mindfulness that very few people actually instruct you on. It's not just being mindful, but how powerful your mindfulness is. Because once you do some meditation, you become very still, very peaceful. The energy starts to pour into mindfulness. Usually you'll waste your mental energy on doing things, thinking, reacting. When that energy is stopped, it can only go into one place, into knowing, into awareness. And that is brilliant. Literally, your mind wakes up and starts to have power. It's like turning on the lights in this room. You can see more. You can taste deeper. You can smell more. Your senses are becoming alive and amplified. And everything you see in so much more detail. And it becomes so much more beautiful. It becomes incredible. You go out with superpower mindfulness, you look on a leaf and a tree. Wow, there's so much going on in there. So many different shades of green. And just the whole leaf is, the greens are more powerful than you've ever seen before. This is a nature of mindfulness which has really started to get empowered. And that never happens with sleep, but it certainly happens with meditation. And I love telling the story. I told this a couple of times in the United States last week. People love this story because it's gross. I was on my teaching a meditation retreat in Australia. And I was getting such incredible meditation. And after I came out from one meditation, my mind was incredibly powerful. And you just saw just a blade of grass outside. It was like fluorescence. Could see so much more. But I couldn't stay looking and enjoying the blade of grass because I had to go to the toilet. And I had to do what we call a number two. You know what a number two is? Well, number one is urination, so you get to understand what number two is. They know that in Australia, in the United States, straight away, a number two. So I did a number two in the toilet bowl, and my mistake was actually to have a look afterwards. Wow! Never, ever in my life have I seen something so beautiful. Now, honestly, you know, just have you ever looked, you know, what you do and what's left in the bowl? You know, these little balls, the way they were stuck together, it was just like a Michelangelo sculpture. And it was just and just the colors there, the colors. It wasn't just the brown. Just this whole different shades of brown. And the way those colors interacted with each other. It was just an artistic masterpiece. And I always remember, just because there's always a tiny bit of mucus there somewhere, the way the mucus and the water interacted, it was like diamonds. It was sparkling in the bottom of the toilet bowl. And now the fragrance, you know, was really rich and filled your whole nostrils with this flavor explosion. Is powerful and incredibly wow. And I was looking in this toilet bowl for about 5 minutes going, wow, look at that, that's incredible. And And I honestly, I really did think of picking it up and showing my friends. And it was only the fact that I've been trained as a monk, I know how to let go. It was tough. It was different, but I did it. It was a very sad thing, but I pressed the button. And the most beautiful piece of shit I'd ever seen vanished from my life forever. I love telling that story because, you know, it was true. You know, when you get really powerful mindfulness, you know, even the contents of a toilet bowl look incredibly beautiful. Let alone you go out and see a flower, or you see just, you know, a sunset, or you taste food. This is one of the great benefits of meditation. Your senses get enhanced manyfold. And whatever you see is incredibly beautiful. You get heaps and heaps of joy. Everything becomes delightful. So in the deep meditation, you have huge amounts of happiness. And this is one of the reasons why when you really get into this, wow, you're flying, having a great time. And that's one of the reasons why I became a monk. I don't mind telling you this. You've heard it before, maybe. I became a monk because, you know, I was still a student. And I remember just, I had a girlfriend. She lived in Gloucester. So I was visiting her, had sex with her, good sex. And when I, 3 days later, or 4 days later, I was on a retreat, 5 or 6 days later, I had such a wonderful meditation. It was better than good sex with your girlfriend. Much, much better. And that really blew my mind. The fact that you had a pleasure, you know, sheer pleasure, sheer joy, which was better than orgasm. And I never realized such a thing was possible. And I was a bit upset. Why hadn't anyone told me about this before? And of course, once you start tasting that type of stuff, you really want to do more meditation. Really get into it and find out why. That's really what happens. So some of you, when you really get into this stuff, you really have a huge amount of happiness and joy. Do I look like a happy monk or a miserable monk about to get depressed and kill myself? You know, you've seen me a long time. I'm probably the least depressed person in the whole of Hong Kong. And this is one of the reasons why. Your meditation gives you incredible power. Happiness power. You see so much more. When it comes to insight, seeing deeply into things, that's the type of mindfulness you need. The powerful stuff. When it comes, don't think that you can't do it. It works. One of the people, just on my last retreat, they were on the toilet, but they never looked at the toilet bowl. They looked at this tile, you know, on the just right in front of them. And the tile just exploded at them. You know, just centrally. It was incredibly beautiful, sparkly. The deepest white you'd ever seen. And there's a sign her meditation was taking off. And even as William Blake said, one of the great poets, to see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. Now that guy knew superpower mindfulness. Just a tiny grain of sand, you see a whole world in there. And a wild flower, this tiny little thing, a whole heaven in there. Huge amounts of joy and bliss. That's when you get into the really interesting stuff of meditation. Now, the stuff which monks and nuns really get into and have a wonderful time. And you get into that as well, so if you come on retreats. Great stuff. And your shit looks beautiful. I love being gross. Do we need to help older kids, teenagers, to practice mindfulness and meditation? This seems to be contradicting to their world of school teaching, like kids like to be competitive, outspoken, performing leadership, etc. Look, I learned my meditation as an 18-year-old at university. It helped enormously. Many kids do meditation at school and university. It helps enormously. I was at about 6 or 7 years ago, the first public school, you know, over in UK, I think it was Wellington School. Their principal started teaching meditation as a compulsory subject for every year, one lesson a week. Compulsory. And when the newspapers found out, of course, they interviewed the principal, the headmaster. Are you a Buddhist? I'm not a Buddhist. I'm a Christian. Well, why are you teaching meditation to all the kids? And he said, because of my job is to increase the academic performance and social skills of the kids under my care. The evidence is compelling, scientific evidence. So this works, and I've seen it work. It gets better O-level and A-level results for the children in my school. That's why I do it. And if that's the school in the UK, why aren't schools in Hong Kong? Many schools are doing this now. Teaching, they call it mindfulness instead of meditation, so that people of other religions don't get challenged. So it doesn't matter what you call it. It works for your kids. And it increases their grades, their success rate. Now when you tell your children, the evidence is strong, you can look it up in the internet, you will get higher grades in O-level and A-level if you meditate, with less work. And of course that makes it really attractive. And they'll do it. It's a really cool thing to do. And if that doesn't convince them, tell them that this Kuai Lo monk you just saw had just returned last week from Google and Facebook, where they do meditation. I was in Facebook, this is the Facebook campus, you know, the headquarters. And I told last night, because, you know, they brought this huge tract of land to build all their buildings, you know, they got their own private road, and you know, they named the road Hacker Drive, and the address of Facebook is number one, Hacker Drive. Because they made the road, they named it themselves. It was a really stupid name to call it. And number two, you know, they got meditation room in there. And I was teaching meditation in Google and also in Facebook. So this is cool places to be. So tell your kids that in Google and Facebook they do meditation. So if you want to be cool, you better do meditation too. We are planning on having a child in the near future, but I generally have a phobia towards medical treatments and surgery. Do you have any meditation techniques or advice that can help me through the pregnancy and perhaps during delivery? I know all about pregnancy. Number one, it's just the worry about it is a problem. And, you know, when you do go, you know, into labor, don't call it labor pains. Call it labor energy. There's a simple thing. I read that in a book a long time ago about this hippie community in the United States. Started, now there are a bunch of hippies, but they decided to reinvent childbirth. And now people tell me it's a classic text which everybody learns when they do midwifery. You know, invented by a bunch of hippies. Number one, change the language. If you call it labor pain, you're expecting it's going to hurt. And my goodness, it does. You call it labor energy or labor forces running through your body. And then it's amazing. That psychologically changes the whole feeling to be this huge energy just flowing through your body. You don't call it a pain. And of course, you don't fight it. You let go. You know, that because these were hippies from California, they said, imagine surfing the waves. You've got to become one with the waves. Surf it. Don't resist it. Just go totally with the flow. And these hippies, you know, this doctor was writing all these things. This is incredible. Shorter labor periods, healthy babies, and these women were showing no signs of pain. They just had incredible births. And this is how it can be done. Simple Buddhism or meditation, letting go, not fighting, being in a moment, feeling the body as this is happening, not resisting it, letting it be, kindfulness. And you have great births and they're powerful. Not to be missed with medication. When you're afraid, you tense up and it gets much worse. Just like I cured my stomach poisoning, food poisoning. Terrible pains. Just relax. With meditation, you learn how to relax to the max. And it's so easy. So, if you want to have a baby, come and see Ajahn Brahm. I'll tell you how to do it. Once you're pregnant, that is. Simply nosy. Simply nosy. I am from the information. From the information in your background, you went to Dharma University. Did you get teaching courses or a degree in education there? Yeah, I did just the 1 year. I call it Diploma of Education, I think. What to know where Wonder Monk is coming from? Oh, thank you. You're a very good teacher. Wonder Monk. Now, it's not Wonder Monk. That's why I keep opening, because underneath here I've got this big S underneath. Super Monk. And actually, it didn't work, but there was a person who said they were a friend of Steven Spielberg's. And I was actually making the suggestion, look, you know, you see they have all these superheroes, you know, on the movies. They've got Batman, Superman, Green Lantern, Flash. These are all the people I used to read in the comics when I was young. And then Iron Man. Who else they got? Spider-Man. But they've done all that already. Now the next superhero will be Super Monk. And Super Monk, his special power is obviously levitation. So he can levitate all over the place, because that's traditional for a monk. And whenever there's a terrorist attack, now instead of like, you know, these other violent people, now the Super Monk actually, you know, stops the explosion just by the power of his mind. And then all these terrorists, he doesn't shoot them or blast them with rays of whatever these people have. He just sits them down, teaches them how to be mindful, and they become these really peaceful people afterwards. That would be Super Monk. Just another, the superhero franchise with a little bit of difference. But apparently it didn't fly with Steven Spielberg for two reasons. One, there was no violence and no sex. And a movie without violence and sex doesn't sell. So Super Monk didn't manage to fly. It's true, isn't it? That's what people like, violence and sex. Unfortunately, I did actually, what was it? Sarah Jessica Parker, Sex in the City. She was actually photographed reading my book. And she was in a coffee shop reading Who Ordered the Truckload of Dung, that first book. And so I thought, wow, as soon as I heard this, I thought, she's going to get inspired, become my disciple, and invite me to do a cameo on Sex in the City. That would be really cool, fascinating. But we'd have to change the title, you know, just for that one episode. No Sex in the Monastery. It's for Sex in the City. It never happened, but I do dream. I just want to say thank you, since in the meditation of past and future shopping bags, I began to know that I'm worrying about the future. That's why every time when I meditate, I can only relax in my something body, but not the other left side body, but not the right side of my body. Now I'll try to let go of my worries about future. Thank you. Yeah, look, you can't predict the future. It's a total waste of time about worrying about the future. Everything ever I worried about the future never happened. All those terrible things I imagine would happen, they never happened at all. Worse things did. So that's no, they didn't. But it's a saying of the Buddha, whatever you think it's going to be, it will always be something else. And that was amazing. You know, when you understand the meaning of that, whatever you imagine it's going to be, your future, guaranteed it will be different than anything you can imagine. Isn't that true about your future? You plan it, but it always goes on a different course. More interesting course. And that's one of the reasons why I don't worry about the future. When I look after my present moment, that's the best I can possibly do for my future. That's my insurance, being here. How can you explain scientifically that one can heal diseases like cancer using meditation? It sounds so unbelievable. You know, I was a scientist before, and whether it's believable or not, you have to face the evidence. And the evidence is there. It's compelling. You see people. You know, you see your own sort of food poisoning. You're not imagining this. And it hurts like hell. No one in their right mind can imagine pain like that. You wouldn't inflict that on yourself because it hurts like hell. But you can actually meditate it away. You see that, and it works. And it's the other people, that guy who had the psoriasis, he wasn't imagining this, you could see it on his body, all over. It was one of the grossest things I'd ever seen. And it went. Guys with cancers, you can see those tumors. The guy can't breathe. He's not just doing this, you know, on purpose, breathing in and out really loud. It's only because he can't do it any other way. And then it goes. So I've seen too much of that. The evidence is really strong. How it happens, that's for someone else to work out. But you know the evidence is there. These are the facts. And you have to fit your theories to meet the facts. It's another saying of mine. Please don't bend the facts to fit your theories. Bend the theories to fit the facts. It's obvious, that's science. It works. My daughter always afraid of dark when she sleeps alone at night, that she can't sleep and cries all night since she was a baby. And now she is 17. Wow. How can a mother can help her in this situation? Because her body health is affected. She's afraid of... You know, one interesting thing to do, if she's been afraid of the dark for such a long time, very often it can be a trauma from the past life. So see if you can find someone to give her hypnotic regression. Because that is really powerful. One of my friends does that over in Australia. They take a person, you know, put them under hypnosis. They're very skilled at this. And they take them back to a previous life. Now, whether this is a real previous life or not, it always works. They get back to this previous life. Sometimes it's very dark, you know, at night time, and they had some trauma, murdered or raped or whatever. And that's the reason why they're afraid of dark in this life. And they go back to that previous life, they relive that trauma, and it means afterwards they have the catharsis. The dark doesn't bother them again in this life. So that's a really good thing to do, because it works. I've seen, again, many cases of that. So try that. Now, there's one of these cases. This is a fascinating case. There was this girl who had anorexia. She's about 16. You know anorexia, you know, you eat, you vomit it out of bulimia or whatever it's called. And she was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. A doctor couldn't help her. Psychologist couldn't help her. Psychiatrist couldn't help her. So last resort, they took her to one of these regression therapists over in Sydney. And you know, her mother took her. So her mother was with her all the time just to make sure, because she was underage, only 16, I think. And you know, she was a good subject. First session, she got into her past life, where she recalled being the younger of two sisters. And her elder sister was the attractive one, and she was plain. And they both fell in love with the same man. And men being men, the man chose the older sister who was more beautiful, more attractive. And the younger sister, her in a previous life, she was so heartbroken that she committed suicide in a previous life. Because she couldn't, you know, be with the man she really loved so deeply. Her sister got him. She said, that was me in my previous life. And the reason why I'm anorexic in this life, I'm trying so hard to be beautiful. So over the top, trying to be pretty and attractive. That's why I'm starving myself, because last lifetime, not being attractive just hurt me so deeply. You can see the cause of that. You can see the connection there. But the amazing thing about this story was, while the daughter was saying this under hypnosis, the mother was going hysterical. And when the poor therapist, you know, had to take the daughter out of hypnosis and then deal with the mother, calm her down. Why are you just overreacting like this? And then the mother said, because I was that sister. I never told my daughter this. It's one of these things we just don't talk about. Before she was born, I had a younger sister. And we both fell in love with the same guy. That's my husband, her father. And my younger sister killed herself. And the younger sister got reborn. She couldn't be this guy's husband. She got reborn as the guy's daughter. That's an amazing little story, but true. That's how all these things actually work out. So if you find out what happened in the past, it just fills in a jigsaw puzzle, and we find out what's going on and why it happens. So it could be that her body health is being affected. See if she can do some hypnotic regression. If she's lucky enough to be a decent subject, then when she actually goes back to her past life, problem solved. When can I start introducing my young children to meditation? If they are toddlers and experience temper tantrums, how do I guide them to achieving peace and mindfulness? Is one of my disciples a young woman with two young kids, and she could never meditate at home. Whenever she sat down, one of her kids would pull her hair, would crawl over her, "Mummy, Mummy, I need a glass of water." And every time, Mummy would get up. But then she told me that one day she was totally fed up with her kids. She wanted to meditate. She decided, "I'm going to meditate no matter what they do." And she told me what happened. You know, the two kids, a girl and a boy, forget their names, say Jenny and Peter, say. And then as soon as she sat down, they started pulling her hair to get attention. Even though it sometimes hurt, she would not move. Shouting at her, touching her, she just sat there until they gave up trying to disturb her that way. Now, they're only about 5 or 6, but you know, kids can be psychologically very knowledgeable. So one of them said, "Mummy, Mummy, Jenny's turned on the gas on the oven." "Mummy, Mummy, Peter's got a knife out from the kitchen drawer." It's incredible how clever kids are. But Mother was up to the challenge. She's just sat there. She's going to meditate. She doesn't care if the kids blow up the house and carve themselves up. She's going to meditate. And she sat there for about half an hour, ignoring everything the kids were doing. And when she came out of meditation after half an hour, you know, the kids were quietly playing in the corner. Now, they hadn't blown up the house. They hadn't chopped off each other's arms. That was just the threats, because they wanted Mummy's attention. And now, after that, she's won her meditation time. She can meditate any time. Because, you know, she meditates, sits down, the kids know, okay, Mummy's meditating, nothing we can do. And they just play quietly together. And now they also learn that Mummy can meditate. And so sometimes they sit down next to her. Because that's what kids do, they imitate the parents. It's a wonderful way of teaching toddlers. And sometimes it's not just your kids, but sometimes the dog. The cat comes to sit next to you. Because they get off on the piece as well. It's amazing how many times you see that. You have a little dog, and you're sitting quietly there. The dog sort of sits next to you. They get off on the piece. They know something's happening. So that's how you teach toddlers. By example. But this weird story, I love weird stories. One of my disciples, she'd just given birth to a kid in hospital, and maybe about 2 days, 3 days after birth. And she was laying in the bed, you know, the bed was reclining, and she just finished breastfeeding her kid. I wish she had an iPhone and taken a picture of this. This would have been absolutely amazing. Just finished breastfeeding her kid, and the kid crawled onto her tummy. And no, she said, "It wouldn't lie to me, this happened." And the kid crossed its legs in full lotus, put one hand over the other, closed its eyes, and for all intents and purposes, it looked like it was meditating. It was only about 2 or 3 days old. Just had a good meal, and then decided to meditate on its mother's chest. Amazing. Freaked her out. But, you know, she just let the baby sit there. Amazing. I do fine when meditating in a group with guidance. However, when I do it alone at home at night, I become very scared of the silence and the dark when I have my eyes closed. You know, get the guided meditations. Put the things in your ears with your iPhone, and that would help enormously. You can do it with the lights on. And anyway, no fear, Ajahn Brahm is here. When I talk about achieving peace and calming our minds, when I speak to my partner during a heated argument, he finds me condescending and gets more enraged. How do I deal with his afflictive emotions? They escalate uncontrollably. Okay, look. That's one of the things the Buddha said. You don't talk about peace to people who are angry. You know, it makes them a bit sort of jealous about it. So, you know, when your husband is getting really upset, you know, you find you've been with that person long enough, you should know what works now. One of the things which works when a person is upset and getting very angry at you, you notice when people are angry, the pitch of their voice raises and they talk really fast, and that makes you even worse and you get excited and very upset. But instead of talking like that, when your husband is shouting at you, raising his voice, you just speak very slowly in a very low-pitched voice. And after a while, it calms him down. Now, using your voice, you can actually control people. I remember going to this auction. We were buying this place which became our nuns' monastery, and I was just watching. Had a guy doing the auction for us and actually bidding for us. And I saw the way that they do these auctions to sell houses. And they start off and say, this is a wonderful property. It's just an incredible bargain. So we're going to start the bidding. Let's start the bidding at, say, 1 million Hong Kong dollars. Any advance of 1 million, 1 million, 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 1 million, 4 million, what's another 1 million? You get so excited, everyone bids and they don't realize what they're doing. And it gets so exciting. And this is where they make people get so excited they don't know what they're doing and they bid what they can't afford. But imagine if the auctioneer was very slow and said, this house is on sale for 1 million Hong Kong dollars. Does anybody want to bid any more? That's not the way to sell things. The selling things, you've got to make people crazy, so they buy things they don't really want. So that's actually how you can calm people down, by using your voice in a good way. So if that's your husband, and he gets more and more enraged, it means, you know, you're actually feeding that anger. So be smart, talk very slowly, and, you know, talk very kindly. Husbands, it should be pretty easy, you know, to sort of control after a few years of marriage. Come on. I'm working with offender services, how to let them believe that they can start anew, no need to return to old life. Let them see the other part of them which didn't offend, the good, the kind, the beautiful part of themselves. If you really want to do a little trick, it's in the book over there. Get them to get a piece of paper out, line down the middle, their name on the top, and say on the left side of this piece of paper, write down all the reasons why you are in this prison. Then they fill up the left side. When they've finished filling up the left side, then tell them, on the right side, I want you to fill out all the things which you admire about yourself, all your beautiful qualities, any kind things you've ever done. Sometimes it's hard for them to do that. You have to help them. You know, did you feed the cat this morning? Yeah, okay, put that down. Anything, just to get it started. And once they've finished putting down all their good qualities on the right-hand side of the paper to balance the things they did, which is the reason why they're in jail, and get a pair of scissors out, cut it down the middle, put the left-hand side in a trash can and give them the right-hand side, their good qualities, and say, keep this. Put it up by your bedside. Look at it every day. This is your good qualities. Anything to get them to look about the things in them which are the beautiful side. There's plenty there. Once you start seeing, it's very easy to see. Would you give advice to those who work with offenders with lots of frustration? You've got to be very patient when you work with other people. And if in all your life you just help one person, one prisoner, one offender get their life back together, then it's worth it. Just one person is enough. And then if you find at the end of your life you've done hundreds of people and you've given a life to. It's a wonderful thing to do. Doctors can help mothers give birth to babies. They can take a person with cancer and get rid of their cancer. They can give them life, physical life. But you, if you're working with an offender, you're giving them emotional freedom, emotional life. You're giving birth to a new person who can live a beautiful life, a productive, a happy life after they leave jail. You are like a person who helps give birth. Very fulfilling. How can you explain the death of a baby? Isn't it cruel to snatch away a baby suddenly? Remember reincarnation, they get another chance afterwards. And I sometimes I tell you, if a baby dies, And it's like, you know, have you ever gone to an airport and get one of these cheap flights and find it's been overbooked and you get bumped off the flight? You know, that's like a baby dying. You know, they've been bumped off, you know, Earth, too quickly. They didn't get, like, the full flight. But if you have been bumped off a flight because it's been overbooked, usually what happens, you get the next available flight and you get an upgrade too. So I tell you, if a baby dies, you know, they get an upgrade in the next life and usually the first available womb because it wasn't supposed to happen. And that's actually, you know, okay, that maybe seems a bit facetious, but that's actually what happens. There was. Here's another good story. How's the time going, by the way? I've lost my watch. Where is it? Oh, I've got another 10 minutes. A Thai couple, very close disciples, she got pregnant, her first kid. So they're really, really, really excited. And they, you know, really good prenatal care. 5 days before birth, had an ultrasound, everything perfect. When they gave birth, they found in those 5 days, the baby had strangled itself on the umbilical cord, had turned, so it was stillborn. So I knew this because I did the funeral. This is the family I know. I did the funeral service for them. They called the boy Charlie. And they had him dressed up, and before they did the cremation, they had the coffin vertical. They held it up and had a family photograph with me in it. So Charlie made it into the family album, just stillborn. But what I didn't see, they told me afterwards, it was like a Thai tradition. When no one was looking, they got out a simple ballpoint pen and they drew a line on the heel of their dead baby, Charlie. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. It was just a bit of bad luck. A few months later, she became pregnant again. This time, perfect pregnancy, and gave birth, this time, interestingly, to a boy. No, to a girl, sorry, to a girl called Anne. And that Anne has got a birthmark across her heel. It's Charlie, come back again. We all know that. Because Anne, now they come to the temple every week, she was the biggest tomboy. She wasn't feminine at all when she was young. And of course, because she was Charlie before. You could see that. And so she had this little birthmark, because you're not supposed to have birthmarks on your heel, exactly as they'd written. So sometimes that happens. A child dies, and they come back again, the next possible chance. So if that happens, now don't be so sad. Get out a pen, mark it somewhere. And see, it's amazing just how many times that happens. And you find it's back again. So it didn't quite make it this time, but you know, you get another try. You know, if you apply for a job, you know, or university, if you don't pass the exams first time, can you try again? Yeah, why not about life as well? So if they don't make it first time, you can always have another go. Isn't that nice? How to cultivate kindness to oneself and others. How to cultivate contentment when the world keeps reminding you it is not good enough. Who says that's not good enough? You are good enough. If you see the two books on sale, there's one book called Opening the Door of... No, not Opening the Door of the Car. The Good, Bad, Who Knows book. There's also another book on sale outside, which shouldn't be on sale because it's illegal. The Don't Worry, Be Grumpy book. You know, they got... The rights for Hong Kong have been given to Body Nine International Foundation, BIF. That's why we did The Good, Bad, Who Knows. The Don't Worry, Be Grumpy is the American version. And then they shouldn't be sold in Hong Kong. It doesn't matter anyway. But the difference between those two books, the stories are the same, the title is different, but there's something extra in the Don't Worry, Be Grumpy book, which is the happiness license. And somebody just showed it to me, and I signed it for them. And the happiness license says that this license grants to the bearer permission to be happy without let or hindrance for any reason whatsoever or no reason at all for the rest of their life, signed Ajahn Brahm. So there's a happiness license because everyone else is telling you you're not good enough. And I sign a form. If you respect me and think I know what I'm talking about, and think I'm just worth believing and having faith in, then I sign this happiness license for you. So the world may not say you're good enough, but Ajahn Brahm says, yes, you are good enough to be happy. So you have a license from the boss, Ajahn Brahm. You can be happy. It actually works. Because a lot of times people think they don't deserve to be happy. So they need permission from somebody they respect. If you can't get it from me, I'll get you something from Obama. Or sort of the president of China. Or whatever. Give everyone permission in Hong Kong to be happy. Sign the president. Or is it the chairman? What are they called? Chairman. Okay. So would that make you happy? You got permission that you're good enough? Signed by the head of the Chinese government? Signed by me, the Pope? Would that do? The Dalai Lama? God? God hereby signs that you are good enough. Would you believe it if you got a note from God that you're good enough? You've been taught ever since you were small that you weren't good enough. And that's just a stupid thing to teach people. If you have children, please don't ever inculcate the fact that they're not good enough. Say to them, look, I don't care where you go to in school, you are more than good enough. No, you're my son, I love you. And anyway, what I keep telling people, if your children, if you can't, your children come in the top 10% or bottom 10% at school or university, they are not good Buddhists. They come in even the top 10%, they're not good Buddhists. Because in Buddhism, we believe in the middle way. If they're in the middle somewhere, then yes, son, you're a good Buddhist. You know, all the children, they hear this. And because they hear this, they tell Mom, Dad, and they want to say, how did you get to go to school? I was in the middle, just like Ajahn Brahm said. Okay, Mom, Dad. And the poor parents can't say anything because I said it's okay to be in the middle somewhere. Because, as I said last night, you don't need to be at university to be successful. Happy people are successful because success is happiness. There is happiness. There is success. So make happiness success. And then you don't need to be top of the class. You don't need to be the richest person in Hong Kong. You don't need to be the CEO of the company. You're successful because you're happy. How's the time going? It's getting about 4 o'clock already. We're supposed to finish at 4. What time is it? Is it 4? You're saying no because you want me to carry on. Squeeze more out of me. Okay, just... No, it's only 2 questions. That's karma. Those questions won't be answered. These 2 will. That's karma. Leave them on the floor, otherwise I'll get in trouble. I won't finish in time. When I do the sitting meditation, sometimes the body likes to have move or shake uncontrollably. The movement sometimes back and forth, sometimes in a circular motion. Why this happens? Should I follow my body more or should I control my body to sit still? Thank you. No, leave it alone. If you, especially if you're sitting on a chair, wear a seatbelt. That'll stop you. No, it doesn't matter. If there's some extra energy in there, just it will disappear by itself. But quite frankly, a lot of time it feels like that, but you're actually perfectly still. Now, you won't believe me, whoever wrote this. Say, no, I'm moving. Get a friend to video you. Honestly, get into video, and you'll be just stunned to find you were certain you were moving, but actually you're perfectly still. It's just the mind, perception playing tricks on you. I've seen that many, many, many times. I have dreams every night for nearly 10 years. The dreams make me very awake, that I never think I have slept at night. So when I wake up in the morning, I either feel very sleepy, tired, or have a serious headache. How can I do this? Okay, this is a very good way. It reminds me of the story of the hospital in Hong Kong. And the person woke, he was in some ward, I forget where. And when he just had an operation, when he came out from the anaesthetic, he complained to the nurse he had a splitting headache and he had a big bump on his head.
And so he asked the nurse for some aspirin. And I said, "What do you mean? There's nothing wrong with you. You know, you just had a stomach operation. There's nothing to do. We didn't touch your head." He said, "No, I've got a splitting headache. And I've got a really hot on top and I've got a bump there." So the nurse actually had a look at him. And sure enough, he had a swelling on his head. And so she immediately contacted the surgeon. She said, "There's some really weird complications here. You know, it was only a sort of this keyhole surgery to his intestines. And he's complaining about a headache, and he has got a swelling on his head." I said, "Oh, yes, yes, sure. I know the reason why. It's because in the operation, we ran out of anesthetic." Because that's the way they have to cut costs in hospitals in Hong Kong these days. Is that what they do in Hong Kong? So that's what you can do if you can't sleep at night. Get your partner to... Now, what you really do is... Don't do that, otherwise you get sued or someone will get sued. You have dreams every night for nearly 10 years. So, when you go to bed tonight... I tried this with a person recently and it worked 100%. Brilliant. When you go to bed tonight, whoever wrote this, you know, tuck yourself in, get yourself very comfortable. And then, you know, once you're comfortable, relaxed, repeat to yourself, "I will sleep without dreams. I will sleep without dreams. I will sleep without dreams." Then forget what you said and just go to sleep. But while you say that, pay full attention. Say it in your own words. It's called programming your mind. And it's very powerful. If you put that program in there just before you go to sleep and you listen to it carefully with as much mindfulness as possible, you know, it actually retrains your mind. So when you go to sleep, you just don't dream. Or you can say, "I can dream pleasant dreams." You can program that. When I go to sleep, I'll have happy dreams. When I'm sleeping, I'll have happy dreams. When I sleep, I'll have happy dreams. Program that. And it works. Or if you're short of cash, program your mind, "I will dream of the lottery number. I will dream of..." No, don't do that. So, but you can program your mindfulness by making a very clear statement, especially when you're sort of tucked up in bed before you go to sleep. Say it clearly, in your own words, pay attention, and it does work. Because that happened recently. A lady, she had all these very difficult dreams and asked me what to do. This advice I gave, she came back up, was brilliant. It worked first time. Now I have a very good night's sleep. Try it. Okay, so we're supposed to do lots of meditation. I only do 2 sessions. I'm sorry about that, but it's your questions, and you had more of them, so I'm sorry. They didn't answer all of them, but that was obviously karma, just they fell down by themselves. I didn't really push them. So thanks a lot for listening. If you want some more, there's lots of other talks going on. So thank you, everybody. Does anyone... Okay, very good. Is there any other people who can sum up or anything? Or just... No. So it's free and easy. Free and easy. Nice to see you. This is about, was it 4th, 5th time I've been here? So I'll probably come again next year. See you, same place, same time, next year. Be good, and please don't do anything I wouldn't do. Thank you. And you are released from that last one.